You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome once again to the Parish Council. This is the podcast from the Rocking Vicar. I'm Magnus Shaw, and here we are now. Entertainers, it's Terence to come.
Hello, Magnus Shaw. How are you?
Yes, I'm really, really very good.
It's Saturday, and it's a bit of a grim, drizzly day down in the south.
Yeah.
I was thinking of going out this afternoon. I was going to go and watch my second team because Chelsea are away, which is my local team from when I was a boy, Staines Town. They're at home this afternoon, but I'm now beginning to think, I might illegally watch Chelsea through, that thing, the internet.
I've heard mention of it.
Yeah. But apparently you can watch football matches that you're not supposed to, through it. I mean, I wouldn't know anything about that at all.
No, I would have thought that was highly illegal in the rules.
I understand it may be.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't do that, but it certainly would be a temptation rather than going to sit in the blustery surroundings of Staines by the Thames.
So next podcast from your prison cell, I should imagine.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah.
Wormwood Scrubs on Skype.
Yes. It's funny you should say that, actually, because I have here about my person, well, not about my person, but in the house, two free tickets to go and watch my local team in Derbyshire, including a sit-down lunch and a free bar.
How fantastic. Yeah. Which team is it? Or are you not able to say?
Chesterfield Town FC.
How fantastic.
Yeah.
I assume you're going.
No, I'm not going. No.
Because of your aversion to football?
Yeah, it involves watching 90 minutes of football, and that's 90 minutes I'll never get back. So.
Oh, dear. I blame the lack of education, really.
I have promised them to two other bodies who are going to be collecting them shortly. So.
Oh, good. So they won't go to waste.
They won't go to waste. No, but I did have it in mind to go and have a couple of Coca-Colas and a free sit-down lunch and then come home, but I was advised that the company that kindly furnished me with the tickets would not view that with any great respect. So when I discovered that I would actually be expected to troop out and watch the football, I can't think of anything.
Oh, it's lovely going to watch the lower division games because Chesterfield, I'm afraid, are not in the Premier League. But it's lovely going to watch this game. So I like going to see my old hometown club, Staines Town, because it's just lovely. You get such a much more sense of involvement. You can hear all the shouts from the players and the interaction with the referee, and the crowd get a sort of really involved, and you're so close to the action as well. It's lovely. It's a completely different experience to the kind of high-profile business world of the Premier League. It's a completely different universe altogether. It's lovely.
Sounds tremendous.
I haven't convinced you, have I?
No.
We've been watching television this week. We looked at a couple of programmes for review, and the first one we looked at was basically it's Racism Week on Channel 4.
<It is. Yeah. laughs>
I'm not sure they're marketing it that way, but that's the long and the short of it. Proud and Prejudiced on Channel 4 on Monday highlighted a multitude of issues in the community of Luton in Bedfordshire, where 15% of the community are Muslim, which is five times the national average. And we focused on two individuals in particular, Saiful Islam, a follower of the radical cleric, as they always call him, Omar Bakri, and Stephen Leonard, who inexplicably had changed his name to Tommy Robinson, and he was from the English Defence League. I found the programme thoroughly depressing and have a few thoughts on it, but what were your views on Proud and Prejudice?
Well, I thought this was I enjoyed the programme in terms of its validity as a documentary. I thought it was an interesting conceit. What I thought it was a study in confusion. I thought it was a film about two very, very confused people, Tommy Robinson, Stephen Leonard, being perhaps even more confused than his opposite number. What he appears to be trying to do is to rebrand far-right racist politics in a most confounded way, really. The English Defence League claim to be great supporters of the black British community, great supporters of the gay British community, but absolute vehement opponents of the British Muslim community. I don't know how that works. This is sort of narrow casting your racism, isn't it?
Specialised
racism. You know, they didn't mention the Jewish community at all. But the BNP have attempted to do this, haven't they? To say, oh, you've totally misunderstood us. This isn't about racial discrimination at all. This is about every British person being proud of it. Which is, you know, when you see them in action, it's quite transparently nonsense. Tommy's attempts to convey the subtleties of this philosophy to his followers was rather like watching somebody try to explain Proust to a pack of beagles.
It did a bit, didn't it? And I rather felt that there was quite a clever concept of the program, because in the early part of the hour, we were kind of shown the softer side of Tommy Robinson, and you kind of thought, oh, well, you know, I obviously wouldn't agree with his views for a moment, but you can sort of say, oh, well, you know, he's relatively articulate and he's making his points reasonably within that sort of articulate frame. And then slowly, as the hour went on, his whole persona collapsed. Yes. You know, like a building under demolition, because we saw, I am jumping towards the end, and I think we will come back to the middle, but in the end, he went to this rally in Blackburn, and we heard these fateful words: Tommy left the stage and headbutted a rival. And then we saw this other side of Tommy when he'd had a few drinks in particular.
Lobbing things at policemen.
Lobbing things at policemen, which didn't seem, you know, totally to fit in with this sort of responsible head of the English Defence. No. He ended up with a 12-week suspended sentence and community work. I would have given him a much stronger sentence, indeed. Thoroughly unlikable fellow. But I thought both Tommy and Seyfel seemed to be seeking self-publicity more than any cause. And I think both had this tendency to say things to shock and alarm, merely to sort of, again, generate their own persona.
That's the interesting thing with any extremist group, is that on the one hand they do seek to attract publicity. How else are they going to convey their message? And then when they get it, they make such a dreadful pig's ear of it that they end up endearing themselves to nobody except the converted, you know, people equally bigoted and on the lunatic fringe. But they all profess to want to somehow engage with the majority, you know, the general populace, and win support for their cause, which, of course, by headbutting people, throwing things at coppers when drunk, you know, even MPs don't tend to do that, you know. So immediately they're revealed to be, you know, the very confused people they actually are. I think somebody like Tommy Robinson will actually always sit on the fringe of public opinion and in with a small p politics. I have to remind me of his name, the radical Muslim fella.
Seyfel Islam.
Seyfel. I think the problem with Seyfel, what he's doing is much more dangerous, because he is representing a much beleaguered a section of the community, and because he's making a lot more noise than the moderates and the majority of moderate Muslims in the country, it's very easy to take him as representative of all Muslims, and I think that starts to become very dangerous, and it starts to very much play into the stereotypes painted by people like Tommy Robinson. So I think his game is a more dangerous one. Tommy Robinson is just a boorish lout who's managed to get himself very confused about what he believes in. Seifel, I think, is involved in something much more pernicious.
There was a couple of interesting quotes from this Seifel character, and there was one sentence in particular where he sort of led you in, and you're thinking, oh, all right, and then there was like a at the end of it, because he said, well, you know, you have to understand that, you know, the Islam that I'm standing for, we want to prevent drugs. Oh, okay. We want to prevent prostitution. Oh, okay. And homosexuality.
Yeah, you knew that was coming.
Oh, no, Seifel, you know, oh, God. Yeah, so, but on the other hand, though, on the other side, interesting very much in the framework of the old National Front, against whom I attended many marches and gigs in the 70s and 80s. Yeah. They all seem to be lifted from the same mould, don't they, Magnus? Yeah. They all seem to conform to the bullish kind of build, shaven head, frothing at the mouth, tattooed.
Yes.
They really were out of central casting, weren't they?
They really were, and I think what this tells us, when you hark back to the National Front, is really we have nothing to fear from these people, from the far right, because they're exactly the same messages delivered in exactly the same way to exactly the same people. Was happening, back in 1976, 1977, and gained no traction. And then we had the British movement in the 80s and early 90s, gained no traction. And then the BNP in the noughties, absolutely, I think they filed for bankruptcy recently, I believe. And a lot of their leading lights have been charged with various financial shenanigans. And now in come the English Defence League with Tommy, and they will gain no traction either. We really must view these people as a bit of a circus act that all right-minded people can point at and laugh at and carry on about their business being decent and intelligent.
I loved those Rock Against Racism gigs in the 70s. I remember going to see the Clash at Hackney, and it was in fact, it's one of my few credited movie appearances, because you see the top of my head and the side of my face in Rude Boy, the movie, a few times from that gig at Hackney. But it felt then that there really was a movement, and particularly with young people, we really did feel sort of strongly that there was potential to change this. But I do sense a certain apathy these days. I'm sure the feelings are still strong, and as you rightly said a few minutes ago, the Tommy Robinsons as well are very much a tiny minority. But I don't get the same sense of passion, particularly of young people, against this kind of thought process.
I think, I think one of the reasons is, the last perhaps two generations have not been in any way as politicised as we were in the 70s and 80s. But also, I think the anti-racist passion isn't quite as strong with young people now, because they've in a way, the Anti-Nazi League and the groups that we used to support have almost achieved what they wanted to achieve, in that most young people don't have a hang-up about race, about their friends being from different backgrounds and different colours. There are exceptions, of course, but on the whole, my kids don't go on rallies against racism, because racism is so preposterous to them that in the same way they don't go on rallies against sour milk. It's just something that is they don't even countenance. And so to a certain extent, maybe the battle's been won, but not the war. But my kids are not impassioned about the threat of racism, because they view racism as just being utterly ridiculous anyway.
So. Yeah, I take your point. I think that's that's a very telling point. I think that's spot on. And that actual thing about the battle and the war. Well, the battle is still clearly raging in Bradford, because having watched that programme on Monday, we both decided that we would follow it up on Channel 4's Obsessive Week about this issue to watch on Thursday, also on Channel 4, Make Bradford British, yeah. A two-part programme, and this was part one. As a result of the publicity for the programme, they did publicise a sort of form of the citizenship test that you could take on the Channel 4 website. I took it just before the programme, and I scored 13 correct out of 24, okay. And therefore catastrophically failed the citizenship test. And I'm hoping that I'd be able to get to the end of this podcast before I'm shipped away to Guantanamo Bay.
Well, yes, I took the citizenship test online after the programme. And I fared, I'm afraid, a little bit worse than you did. I managed just 12 out of 24. And even my shonky math tells me that's a mere 50%. And, the website throws up a big stamp, doesn't it, that says failed.
No,
to my shame. So yeah, I too am fearing the sinister black-gloved knock on the door from whoever it is who carts you off and flies you to the Antipodes or wherever it is that will accept you. What was interesting about taking this test was that it was nigh on impossible. And the idea that this is predicated on the notion that, look, these are the things that proper indigenous British people know, so we're going to test you, Mr. Immigrant, to see if you know them too. Nobody knows this stuff.
It's ridiculous, some of the questions are just ridiculous. You could only guess.
Yeah.
You'd have to be an obsessive on the particular subject to know the answer.
I would imagine even Tommy Robinson would have failed it.
Yes, I'm sure he would. There was the introduction to the programme, the sort of first few seconds. It's a ticking time bomb, said the mixed racist, race-ish looking lady from a bar in Bradford.
Yeah, she rather mangled her metaphor as well, didn't she? She said it's a ticking time bomb, and all it'll take is one spark. Well, time bomb by definition doesn't require a spark, does it? That's a fused bomb.
No, I suppose not. Yes. she really should have thought out a racist metaphor there. The idea of the programme is eight people coming together to find a consensus. What does it mean to be British? And as we say, it's a two-part show. And I rather feel that part two next week will be the sort of reveal when we see what it's like to actually live the life of someone from a different community, because the second part, I think, from the little excerpts that we saw, will be putting people in situations that they're not normally used to. Indeed, I believe we will be seeing Sabia, the Islamic young lady, working behind the bar of a pub. Yeah. But in the beginning, again, it was quite cleverly edited, because in the beginning we warmed to Rashid. He at the beginning seemed hugely likable, but then we saw Rashid had this belief that he had to go to the mosque five times a day, regardless of anything else going in his world. Yes. So he had offered to cook dinner, and he was late to cook dinner. So he picked up a takeaway, which didn't seem to go down too
now
well.
This trip has been straight out of Four Lions. Rashid had been transplanted from Chris Morris's Four Lions straight into this documentary. I think this is exactly what Chris Morris was doing in Four Lions, was pointing out the sort of absurdities that crop up when you adhere so strictly to a cultural religion and then transplant it into the north of England. I just really thought this is so Chris Morris when he was late with the dinner because he'd have to go and pray again. By the time he'd sorted out dinner, it was time to pray again. So it was really cool. I mean, I'm not laughing at his belief or his culture, but just the juxtaposition of the practicalities of, you know, getting dinner for a group of people when you have to pray every few hours just gave rise to a sort of comic situation, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And then I warmed to him a little bit less when he wouldn't let Sabia pray with him on the grounds that she's a woman. When questioned about this, his only response seemed to be, ask the scholars, which, you know, I thought, oh dear. That seemed a bit retro in views. We had Maura, a 66-year-old ex-magistrate, yes, who again seemed to change her view over the hour. She started off being a rather sort of Iron Lady, Mrs. Thatcherish kind of persona, talking about knowing people who refer with a sort of touch of their nose to our Bradford friends.
Yes, yes,
you know.
Yes.
But she seemed to go on some sort of journey throughout, but I felt the, and actually ties in with what you were saying earlier about how young people today don't really even have this thought process of the of any form of difference. They just get on with life right across the creeds, colours and beliefs, and it doesn't occur to them that it's something to make an issue of. The most unlikable person in the whole of the eight people I found was the ex-policeman called Jens.
Yeah.
Which doesn't seem to me a terribly British name, by the way, but he seemed to be very proud of his Britishness. It was really hard to find a redeeming feature with Jens. Get a sense of humour, he said, after uttering horrid racist cliches.
Yeah, well, this is the Richard Littlejohn defence, isn't it? Is that I will say anything I like, and as soon as anybody objects, I will claim that it was all said in humour and that you suffer from a lack of a sense of humour. You know, it's the oldest trick in the book, and it doesn't hold any water. You know, the things he said, and I think he unleashed his racism, presumably after a few flagons of wine were taken over dinner. His opinions are from a different age and were totally inappropriate in the setting. And I'm afraid you can only accuse somebody of not having a sense of humour if you've said something funny. And he said nothing funny at all, quite the opposite.
Yes. I again wonder whether in part two we'll see Jens complete his journey, because he did seem a little awkward and gave a worried, rather telling glance at the camera when he was being given advice by Rashid about how to sort of integrate.
Yeah, and Rashid's advice was patchy, to say the least. Did have a little difficulty following exactly he is a warm and open fellow, Rashid, but I had a little difficulty following exactly what it was he was guiding anybody towards. But that said, I probably would have trouble espousing my philosophies while trying to steer a narrow boat.
Yes, that was the sudden placement of them all onto this this narrow boat again seemed to have no other purpose other than to push them together and therefore force them to exchange views. And as you say, in Rashid's case, rather I felt unwelcome advice to Jens.
Yeah, that had a touch of the brass eye about it as well. It's, you know, here's a searing social commentary on race attitudes in the 21st century Britain on a narrowboat. I mean, that said, I did like this programme. I liked it a lot. It drew you in. The people they chose from the people who failed the citizenship test were really well chosen, and you felt like you knew them very, very quickly. And I think that's important in a documentary the documentary about race, you have to see beyond people's cultures and colours and see the human beings. And I think the programme managed to do that very rapidly. And you kind of did care about them. You were very interested as to where this experience took them. So I thought the casting was very good. And I thought the programme was very good, surprisingly so, actually. I didn't think it was sensationalist, and I did think it cut to its core message that the only way we can understand racism is to look at the people behind it rather than the ideology behind it. So for me, it worked very well as a programme, but it did have these comic moments, it has to be said.
Well, both Proud and Prejudiced and Make Bradford British are both available on 4OD, the catch-up channel for Channel 4, and you may particularly want to make a point of watching the Make Bradford British if you didn't catch it, because it would then be worth, of course, watching the second part next Thursday on Channel 4 to see the no doubt, I hope, the redemption, particularly of Jens, and to see if they actually can come to this consensus of what actually makes Britain British.
Yes, absolutely. And presumably in the second episode, they'll all be piloting a space shuttle just to just to stir the pot a bit.
Yes, absolutely. Moving from television to the printed media, this week, two sets of sales figures were announced, and we've learned that the Times now has digital subscriptions at the rate of 120,000 people signing up for that digital-only subscription. In other words, the paywall that the Times went behind quite a number of a couple of years ago now. And also in the news this week, of course, we have the launch of The Sun on Sunday last weekend. And I again, rather astonishingly, I found that 120,000 digital subs at the Times astonishing. 3.26 million people bought the first edition of The Sun on Sunday last weekend. And I think it's also interesting that the Mirror, the Sunday Mirror, and the People, having lowered their prices to match The Sun on Sunday last week at 50 pence. They're both going back to full price £1 tomorrow. And I wonder, I worry about the future, mainly for the journalists who work at Trinity Mirror, because both The Mirror and The People had a 30% fall in sales last Sunday, which would, of course, be natural when you see that 3.26 million bought the Sun. Do you find those figures as surprising as I do?
Well, to take the paywall figures, first of all, I didn't really know what to expect from the paywall. It was an enormous leap of faith for Murdoch to say to people to view a website, which is essentially what the online Murdoch papers are websites, you're going to have to pay, which is something nobody is used to outside the field of pornography. And even there, I think the paywalls are the exception rather than the rule these days. And so I didn't really know what to expect. 120,000, yeah, it seems quite high. It's taken them 2 years to get there. I wonder who audits the figures. Do you know that?
I don't. These figures obviously can only come from the Times themselves, because nobody else is able to get access to the figures, unlike where the print media is audited, day on day, but then published month on month. But no, it could and only can come from the newspaper themselves, from News Corporation.
Yeah, I mean that would. I'm not accusing anybody of sharp practice, but if it's not independently audited, it's a bit hard to accept it totally verbatim. I don't know. I think it seems very high to me, and I just wonder why it is so high. This is subscribers rather than users, presumably.
It is subscribers, people who actually pay to gain the information. Now, I think if I've understood these figures correctly, it does include people on long-term direct debit pay, virtually, there for good, but also people who may take a particular interest in one edition and just pay for the one-off.
Yeah, that goes some way to
it. Nonetheless, it's still quite, it's still an extraordinary number of people.
It is. I wonder how many of those payments go on company credit cards. That would be interesting to know, in that, you've got a substantial amount of people working in the media whose employers would understand that there was value in giving them access to the online Murdoch publications, and therefore are happy to pay for their staff to have access to it. So that would be something else. But yeah, it does seem to be, to a larger extent, working for them, if those figures are correct. The Sun on Sunday, we can't really extrapolate anything from that. If you or I launched a brand new national newspaper tomorrow, its initial sales would be quite good, provided we had marketed them in a particular way. And a brand with the currency of the sun, you know, 100 times more so, people would have bought it out of curiosity value. People who buy the sun 6 days a week would undoubtedly then buy it on the seventh. And people going down to the shop for their Sunday paper would have been lured to a new title, like I say, purely out of curiosity. And obviously the other papers lowered their cover price as well, but the 50p cover price won't have done any harm. It won't do 3.26 million tomorrow. I absolutely guarantee it. And that doesn't mean to say it won't fly, that it won't be successful. But the launch edition of any new newspaper or magazine, it is no indicator of how it's going to perform for the rest of its life. I've worked on radio stations whose launch day figures have outperformed anything they've ever done since that day, for the same reason. I didn't surprise me. I mean, the Murdoch's operation would have ensured that it sold out on its first day. I won't go any further than that, but they would have ensured that.
I understand. I wonder, just skipping back to the Times and its huge digital subscription figures, whether some of the increase can be put down to the constant growing number of iPads that I certainly see. It's only anecdotal, of course, but yeah. I certainly see more and more and more people with iPads, whether on a train or in a cafe or you know, wherever. Yeah. Certainly I'm seeing many, many more than, say, 6 months, a year ago. Maybe a lot of people got them for Christmas. Mm-hmm. And whether that links in with the increase in the number of newspaper subscriptions read over that. It's a good form to read magazines.
Yeah, you've got to have the right platform for your online newspaper as well. And now that is much more available than it was when online newspapers were first conceived, as very few people were likely to open up a fairly bulky laptop in a public place and just to read a newspaper. Tablet machines seem to overcome that quite well. I noticed The Guardian now announces that as one of its platforms. It says online, in print, on tablet. So it's a different platform from being online.
I think we could even see a further boost if the rumours of Apple's next step take place, because there's still this slight confusion, a difference between the size of an iPhone, which isn't terribly easy to read, say, a newspaper or a magazine, and it's possible, but it's not a joyous experience.
No.
And then the iPad, which it is, but is still just that little bit too bulky to put in your pocket.
Yeah.
Or it's okay, perhaps if you've got a handbag, it sits reasonably well in there if you've got one of those new bulkier handbags that many women seem to swing around thrashing people in the thigh with.
I thought you were suggesting that I might have a handbag there.
Not at all. There is an increasing number of chaps who wear those sort of across the shoulder
man bag,
man bag, kind of knapsack, halfway between. I think if the rumours coming out of Apple are correct, that we are the next stage is a unit that is halfway between an iPhone and an iPad. In other words, chaps can put it in their pocket, which is, you know, really the thing. Because it's still expensive enough for you not to want to lose it, to leave it somewhere. And, you know, people tend not to do that with their iPhone because you can put it in your pocket or your handbag or man bag or whatever. Whereas the iPad is a little bit still too clunky to be considered absolutely.
Yes, well, I saw the documentary The Tube earlier this week about the London Underground, and it had a segment about lost property. And one of the guys in London Underground Lost Property said that the iPad 2 came out on a Thursday, by the Saturday, London Underground had 14 in lost property.
It's astonishing, isn't it? I mean, it really is astonishing. I can only put that down to people having a few strong lagers or glasses of wine.
Two days for 14 of them. And that doesn't include the ones that were lost and nicked by somebody else. So, yeah.
And how much is an iPad these days?
I don't know. They're not cheap, are they?
Yeah,
I think it probably is. I don't have one. So, yeah.
No, I don't, but only for exactly that reason that I'm fearful of leaving it somewhere. Yeah. I just would. Whereas my phone, I'm kind of trained. I'm tuned in to, you know, make sure it's in my pocket.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I can't cope with another device on top of that. No.
But you wait and see. I bet if this halfway house between the iPhone and the iPad is expected truly, you know, pocket size, but just that bit bigger, many of us will be tempted.
About a year ago, I was watching something. I think it was Click, the BBC technology show, and they were showing some really impressive optical fabric, which, you know, if you imagine a piece of that sort of fairly stiff A4 paper. That had light emitting properties, so could display a screen. So of course, if you have that, then you can just unroll it out of your device, and you can look at anything at any size. But that doesn't seem to have gained any sort of progress.
That would be an absolute breakthrough, wouldn't it? Where something was genuinely, for however you did it, whether you folded it down or rolled it down or however, but you were able to make it the size of a credit card or something, and then you could expand it when you needed it.
Exactly. The technology is obviously there because they were demoing it, but it presumably each device would be, you know, £500,000 or something at the moment. But that looks like something that's on the horizon, and that would change everything, wouldn't it?
At the rate that technology moves, you know, I mean, even, well, let's say, 5 years ago, who would have thought we'd all be sauntering around with iPhones as a sort of everyday object? Mm. So the rate that technology moves, anything is possible by the end of the year, I'm sure. Now, just looking at what we've just been discussing about the progress of Rupert Murdoch's empire in terms of the launch of The Sun on Sunday and the increase of digital subscriptions to The Times. What an amazing contrast if you look on the other side of the fence of News International, because 3 days after The Sun on Sunday was launched, James Murdoch resigned as chairman of News International, the parent company of The Sun and The Times. Although he still retains his place on the parent company, I suppose, grandparent company, News Corp.
The Sun on Sunday, no Sun on Monday.
not for James Murdoch. And this leaves no Murdoch in any senior position now in the UK. And as for the first time, a non-Murdoch, the wonderfully named Chase Carey, it now looks like the number one in the succession to take over from Rupert when that day comes. And in addition to this, Magnus, on Thursday, an 11th Sun journalist was arrested by officers working on Operation Elvedon, which is the Independent Police Complaints Commission investigation into inappropriate payments to police. Yeah. So a real sort of difference over a couple of days between the glory of the sales figures and then the internal strife at News International.
Yeah, and I should just point out, I'm sure the listeners picked up on this, my little gag there was to take sun as in the thing in the sky and the newspaper and then use the word sun as in offspring, you see? Sun on Sunday, no sun on Monday. Yeah, you see what I did?
I'm sure the listeners were grabbing their sides, and I was thinking, I didn't get it, but I kind of acknowledged it, sort of going, yes.
And of course, a joke is always much funnier when you explain it, of course, isn't it? You're absolutely right. And the tale of the of News International and the Murdochs unfolding. It is great. I mean, it is like the fall of the House of Usher, isn't it? You know, for our time. Actually, a closer parallel, I think, is it's like watching The Godfather, in that when holes start to appear in a solid but and successful but corrupt organization, somebody has to carry the can, and it is never Marlon Brando, it is never Michael Corleone, it is never Don Vito Corleone. It's always Fredo, isn't it? It's always somebody close to the throne, but not the throne. And I'm afraid James is Fredo Corleone. He has been nominated, probably much against his will, by the rest of the dynasty to be the fall guy. And this week he's taken the fall. What surprised me is that various commentators were on radio and TV saying how shocked they were. I wasn't in the slightest bit shocked. It was absolutely clear that a Murdoch would have to go. And obviously what Rupert is doing is selecting sacrificial lambs, starting with the News of the World and Rebecca Wade, and working his way through until he feels he's sacrificed sufficient icons of his organization to stave off the damage. James is about as high as he can go now, because he's certainly not going to take it himself. He's really going to have to ride it now, because there's nobody left to sacrifice.
Do you know, it's amazing you mention it being as if scripted as a remake of The Godfather. That is absolutely amazing, because I really had been thinking this very morning the same thing, but in a different way, because, you know, I mentioned earlier this terrifically named fellow, Chase Carey, yes. Who is a non-Murdoch, of course, and is now, essentially everybody reports to Chase Carey that he is... You know, he's the man. In The Godfather, Robert Duvall plays Tom Hagen.
Yes, he does.
Who is the sort of adopted... He is. I love that word. Consigliere. The family lawyer. Yeah. And he's not Sicilian. And yet he grows to have this amazing... He has the ear of Vito Corleone, Marlon Brando. And has a great deal of influence. Mm. And it is astonishing, the parallels between the Godfather, Mario Puzo's original 1969-70 whatever script, and what's going on at News International.
Exactly so, and of course Fredo is sent away to go and try and run the Las Vegas operation, isn't he, to get him out of New York.
He is, and I particularly remember from the movie, he's not particularly blessed with a lot of intelligence, Fredo, is he? And he's very sort of unsure of himself. So perhaps looking into the eyes of James Murdoch, perhaps we can see more parallels than perhaps we ever dreamed of.
So, you know, history tells us that territorial empires never last forever, and so it is with corporate empires. I think word on the street, and this seems to ring true to me, is that the executives in New York really are hanging on for Rupert to go to the great newsroom in the sky so they can offload this British problem.
I think you're right. I think Rupert Murdoch is absolutely tied to the British papers that he owns, and particularly The Sun. He was only, I think, around 40 years old when he first came over here made his mark on publishing. And I think it was from there that the empire was really built, branching into the satellite television broadcasting and all that goes with it. And I think he would be very loath to give up on what he very clearly sees as his baby.
Yes, yes.
But it's not all over yet, even on that sort of negatives and the troubles for the what we tend to always call the Murdoch Empire, because rather underreported, I felt. There was absolutely extraordinary developments in the second phase of the Leveson inquiry this week. There's three phases. We've had the one with, you know, your Hugh Grant and your Steve Coogan and the sort of celebrities. Now we're looking at the second phase, and on, I think it was Monday, Deputy Assistant Commissioner Sue Akers of the Metropolitan Police came up to give her evidence. Now, she's, as well as overseeing this rather tiresomely named Operation Wheating, Operation Toledo, yes. Operation Elvedon, came in to talk about Operation Elvedon this week. And she, I think no one was quite expecting this. She came and gave quite a lot of detail about the police operation, which some legal minds have thought, has she said too much? Will it prejudice the case? Mm. But just to mention that under oath at the Leveson inquiry earlier this week, Miss Akers said that she was aware they'd uncovered evidence of multiple payments yes. by the Sun
oh, yes.
amounting to thousands of pounds yes. to public officials. One person got £80,000,
yes.
a public official. One Sun journalist dished out £150,000 yep. to pay out several sources. Mm-hmm. And she said she'd found evidence of regular payments where some internal accounting meant that those receiving the money weren't recorded. This is a big story that's going to come
from
this.
It's an enormous story. And I think what is happening now is that people are taking heart. People are taking courage. I think with grand conspiracies, their longevity tends to come from fear. So people know it's going on. They disapprove of it. But know if they stand up on their own, they'll just be instantly crushed. But now the cracks are starting to show in the dam. People are taking courage and saying, OK, well, this is not so fearful anymore. And I'm quite prepared now to stand up and say what I've seen and what I know. And that is very difficult, not for Murdoch particularly, but for those who have ridden in his pockets for so many years. There must be some very sleepless nights being had around the capital and around the country from those who have benefited from Murdoch's largesse over the years. There's some very worried people out there, I'm sure.
I'm sure there are, and some of them who've ridden horses, and some of them who haven't, no doubt. But I think
just say to sort of,
yeah, very good. I got that one. To bring it back to the beginning, where we're talking about the launch of the Sun on Sunday. I mean, if we remember the opprobrium that was suddenly ladled on the news of the world, which led to Rebecca Brooks standing up in the newsroom and telling the journalists there that the brand was toxic and it needed to close down. You know, it's the British public can be very fickle, and if something as strong as that evidence around the hacking of a murdered schoolgirl's phone came out and was linked to the Sun, then, you know, despite that 3.26 million, who knows?
Yeah, quite so.
Who knows?
Absolutely. And, you know, one only has to look at the example of Merseyside, where nobody buys the Sun because of what they said about the Hillsborough disaster. That yeah, these things can catch light. It's an unstable ship at the moment, and it'd be very interesting to see whether and how it remains upright. But clearly we could go on for many weeks talking about it because it's such an incredible story. But we'll save the rest for another time and move swiftly on to the immortal pretend iPod, which I know you adore doing every week. I must apologise to listeners. The Prisoner of Love by Spear of Destiny didn't appear on the website last week. The simple reason that it was not in the database that we use for the pretend iPod. So I do apologise. It is on YouTube, but it just wasn't there. But we did manage to get your Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young song in the right format up on there. But anyway, to this week, and I'm going to go first. This week, because I keep very close tabs on who goes first here, and I know it is my turn, and I shall claim it forthwith. And I remember having a conversation with somebody about. the Pet Shop Boys. A few years back, actually, I went to see them in the moat of the Tower of London, which was a fantastic place to see a gig. And I was talking to somebody at this event, and they said, you like the Pet Shop Boys then, do you? A lot. I said I love the Pet Shop Boys a lot. So what do you like so much about them? And actually, it was the manager of the support act who were called Lorraine. And I said, well, apart from anything else, there's nobody quite like the Pet Shop Boys. They are absolutely in their own, in a field of their own, and completely unique. And that's what I love about them. And he said, so you wouldn't say Sparks are like them. And my argument completely collapsed because yeah. Sparks are were the sort of prototype for all those electropop duos, for Yazoo, for Blancmange, for the Pet Shop Boys, and many others besides, Erasure. And they were doing it many, many, many years before all those bands came to prominence in the 80s. Sparks were the originators of that. Delighted to say that they still exist. They're still going. They started out as a rock act, with, you know, proper bass guitar, always keyboards as well. And when that didn't really take on, the two brothers just continued without their rock and roll buddies and started to produce this extraordinary electronic sort of eccentricity, and there really was nothing like Sparks in their heyday. Everybody knows This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us, which still sounds like a really, really odd record, but much loved. And on they continued. Now, the period I really like of Sparks, which probably won't endear me to their loyal, faithful fans, was their late 70s period, when they worked with Giorgio Moroder and developed a very commercial sound. Giorgio Moroder had the magic touch. Certainly, he resurrected Donna Summer's career with I Feel Love and all the rest of it. And he did the same for Sparks. He dragged them out of obscurity and made them a hit-making pop act, but with some absolutely fantastic records. So I'm going to choose the number one song, In Heaven, by Sparks. The full-length version starts with about 2 or 3 minutes of rather celestial ambient sounds, electronic sounds, and just when you think, where the hell's this going, a huge rattle of Lindrums crashes in, and we have this another 3 or 4 minutes of just fantastic upbeat, uplifting, and entertaining and amusing electropop. And this great notion that they have a top 40 in heaven with different music on it, different music from the earthly top 40, and obviously the heavenly top 40 is far superior to the one on earth. And the song you're listening to is the number one song in heaven, which I think is typical Sparks and a very, very entertaining notion. And every time I hear this record, it kind of takes me back to 79, when most of the records I owned were punk records, and sitting in amongst The Clash, The Damned, Susie and the Banshees and the rest of them was this sort of wryly amusing and definitely light pop disco records by Sparks. But I recognised then that they were wholly original. And sorry, Pet Shop Boys, I love you till the day I die, but I have to withdraw the compliment that you are totally unique and original, because Sparks kind of did it first, and this is an example of them doing it really well.
I was always aware of Sparks through a sort of indirect route from their early days, because my sort of superhero of all time musically is Todd Rundgren, and in their early days they were signed to Todd Rundgren's label.
Oh, okay.
And that's how I came to know them, and I think Todd produced maybe the early work that they did, just from memory. But my one and only Sparks story is it coincides with my time as a booking agent in the early 70s, 72, something like that. And I was booking out, the two major acts that we were booking out at the time were Cockney Rebel and Queens, 72, I think, running into 73.
Yeah.
And we had managed to book the unknown Queen into a support slot at the Marquee.
Oh,
a very small club in Waterford.
Oh, you're going to tell me who they were supporting, huh?
And I'm going to tell you, they were supporting your Sparks.
Oh, really?
Who I had never seen, and as I say, I had heard of because of the Todd Rundgren connection. And so, most extraordinary, I think the Marquee Club probably held about 200 people. It was by no means full. I can remember this part. Obviously, it's so long ago, I don't remember much detail, and I was there to make sure that Queen were okay. But, sharing a dressing room the size of a walk-in cupboard at the Marquee in London, probably 72, maybe early 73.
Who knew that Queen supported Sparks? Huh?
Queen supporting Sparks at London's Marquee Club in Wardour Street. Brilliant. In fact, I'll have to look it up later and see if there's any details anywhere online, because I'd love to be reminded of some more detail. It's very foggy in my mind. I can sort of picture you can just see the room being relatively sparsely populated, because neither band had, it was before This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us, and before Seven Seas of Rye.
Right,
but here we go, Magnus. Now picture the scene. Okay. I'm watching football last weekend, and the inevitable commercial break comes on.
Yes.
Featuring DFS sofas,
and for whom I used to write adverts.
You're to blame, are you?
No, I have sales. 2 or 3 years since I wrote anything for DFS.
But wait, instead of the usual thing about here's our sale, it all ends on Sunday. Yeah. Here comes the familiar riff of one of my favourite songs of all time, the unlikely combination of Sunday afternoon sofa selling and the gorgeous groove of XTC's Stupidly Happy.
Yeah, it is odd. Yeah.
The dumbest but happiest song I ever wrote. I found the one riff that Keith Richard hadn't, said Andy Partridge, talking about Stupidly Happy. And it does owe rather a debt to Jumping Jack Flash. And he would be the first to acknowledge. In fact, he has done so in interviews. From the album Wasp Star Apple Venus Volume 2, and written in glorious exultation by Andy Partridge as he found his new love, Erica Wexler, daughter of Jerry Wexler. It's a song that's long been the bridesmaid waiting for the call to the altar to marry up with a commercial. It's been waiting to happen. And McDonald's initially did show some interest, actually, but it was DFS that picked it up 10 years after it was written and released. Now, it's based around a fuzzy guitar riff and a kind of cheery chiming guitar solo. Two bass guitars on it, one running an octave below the other. And wonderfully, about two-thirds the way through the song, it goes from what I can only describe as going from standard to high definition. Another guitar part comes in and boom, it sort of takes off. It's fantastic. The harmonies are based on the model George Martin taught the Beatles: always go lower with the harmony so that the lead vocal dominates.
Yeah.
And it features a middle eight sung by Andy Partridge pinching his nose.
Really? Okay.
Absolutely. Yes. Well, it's wonderful. If I just quickly explain for non-XTC followers, normally in the XTC canon, Colin Moulding would generally write the upbeat songs of love and happiness in the world. Andy tends to write the more reflective and sometimes or the world's, a bit of a journey to have to get through rather than embrace. But because he's in love with Erica Wexler, suddenly his vision is skewed, and he says he's looking at the motorway, and he sees the lights of the cars on the sort of three lane strip of the motorway, looking like it's forming the strings of a guitar. And he sings, "All the lights of the cars in the town form the strings of a big guitar. I'm a giant to play you a tune for wherever you are." So he feels like he's a big giant that's going to come and play the strings of the guitar that are on the motorway. It's from the 13th and last studio album by XTC, 4 minutes, 13 seconds of sheer delight. Stupidly Happy.
Yeah, very, XTC. Very good choice. And just occasionally a song does get used in an ad, and half of you thinks, oh, that's a shame. They've, you know, they've debased that. The other half of you thinks, well, actually, that's just reminded me of what a good record it is. So it does have a dual purpose. And I guess there's a lot of people thinking, oh, yes, Stupidly Happy, XTC. Forgotten all about that. And equally, another group of people thinking, I wonder what that record is, and going and finding out. So, pop songs in adverts, not always a bad thing, I guess. But it's a good choice. And we'll have to trust to fortune that it's on the Rocking Figure database on the iPod for you, alongside my Sparks number one song, In Heaven. Perhaps if it's not, we'll post some links or something. Anyway. We've talked ourselves out, I think, and that brings us to a close for the podcast for this week. Thank you very much for your erudition and enlightenment. I should just mention.
Thank you.
I should just
see
mention
you in 2 weeks.
Yes, in 2 weeks, because we're going to lie down in a darkened room for next week and regain our mojo. In actual fact, you're probably going to watch Chelsea, and I'm going to sit in the desert in Egypt.
In Homs.
Well, yes, I thought I might actually see if I could get moved from Homs to somewhere a little bit more salubrious, but who knows? Anyway, we shall return with more podcasting in a fortnight. So enjoy your week off, and I'll see you in 2 weeks, City. And thanks.
See you then.
And thanks very much to you at home for listening, whether you listen in your loft, whether you listen in the dog kennel, whether you listen in the dishwasher. We do appreciate it, and we look forward to seeing you again in a fortnight. Bye-bye.
Dacom Shore Media Production.